Today's podcast is brought to you by, for the first time,
two
sponsors.
Hey.
We are literally growing by dozens of dollars a day.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
This is fantastic. And we should preface these sponsorship bits by saying that we only accept sponsors on the podcast if they have a product that we really support, believe in, and or use if possible.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we can't use the first sponsor's product, Health IQ, because they are US life insurance and we are Canadians.
But it's still amazing because it's something that you used to rant and rave about all the time when you were an investment advisor, the fact that healthy people paid more for life insurance than unhealthy people, but no more.
Yes. Health IQ has set up their company in such a way that triathletes, swimmers, cyclists, runners, vegans, people who take care of themselves can get as much as a 25% savings on their life insurance, which really just makes sense. That's the way that it should be. That was one of the ranty and ravey things because guys like me, I had to pay just as much as
the burger and fries, never getting off the couch guy.
Yes. Yes. Not ideal. If you want to learn more about Health IQ, go to healthiq.com/triathlonTaryn. They've bundled up all of the triathlete specific information there. Or if you end up calling in or just going to the website on your own, use the code triathlonTaryn. It's not going to save you any money because Health IQ is already
saving you the money.
Ideally saving you money. But let's Health IQ know that you came from us and helps support the show.
And our other sponsor, welcome to the show, Four Sigmatic and their mushroom coffees / drinks.
That's right. This is one that I actually use. I started using Four Sigmatic in early 2017 because I was finding that just the 3 cups of coffee that I have a day was enough to kind of get me addicted. Like I was feeling like I craved it, even though I didn't really want it.
And it didn't taste good.
And by the end of it, like you get that acid feeling and an energy crash at the end of the day. Not with Four Sigmatic. They only have 50 milligrams of caffeine, which is about a quarter to a half as much as a typical cup of coffee. And because it's mushroom based, you don't have that energy crash. You don't have the stomach rot. It's tasty stuff.
Well, and this applies too to non-coffee drinkers because these drinks have benefits that a lot of people can use or would be beneficial to them because they're benefits. So they're made out of mushrooms, all kinds of different mushrooms, cordyceps, lion's mane, chaga, and all of these mushrooms are being found. There's tons of research going into it that they're huge for things like, you know, immune function.
The chaga elixir is not necessarily a coffee, more of an immune booster.
Right. And then there's lion's mane, which supports memory and concentration. You had that this morning. You are clearly on the ball right now.
I am firing on all cylinders right now.
So really cool stuff. Tastes really good. You love the taste of it. You drink this stuff all the time now. And again, tons of benefits for coffee drinkers and non-coffee drinkers alike.
Yep. And we've worked out a deal with Four Sigmatic that if you go to foursigmatic.com/triathlonTaryn or use the coupon code triathlonTaryn, you can save 15% on any order. Not a first order, not a second order, not like limited time only, all the time. Disclosure, that is an affiliate link. So it does help us out if you use that, but help me help you.
Yes, it's good. Go buy it. Yes. Now on to the show.
Today's podcast guest is Rebecca Beaker McKee, who a lot of you might not know, but I've actually been following Rebecca for about 3 years on Instagram. She is a phenomenal age group triathlete. And just this past year, 2017, she had the season of her life and finished first in her age category, first in the 45 to 49 age group. She was the first US female athlete in that age group in the world and 7th overall in the world in the Ironman, half Ironman, like the combined overall world rankings for age group. And this is actually a really big thing because she's been in the sport since the early 2000s. And in about 2010, she was ready to give up her dreams of making Kona. She had overcome a lot of things in her life. She was a cancer survivor, which we discuss how it ends up changing her life and changing her approach to life and how she makes sure that she takes time for herself and enjoys everything that she possibly can. And she had a lot of structural issues with her running stride and how she had a huge amount of injuries that prevented her from having great seasons. And she was just kind of knocking at the door from 2012 to 2016 until last year when she absolutely killed it racing St. Croix, Santa Rosa, half Ironman Hawaii, half Ironman Canada, winning her age group in every single race besides Canada, where she finished second in her age category, even though she dropped a chain in the race. And then she capped off the season finishing top 10 in Hawaii and winning her age group in full Ironman Arizona. We get into all of that. It's been a fantastic journey that she's been on for 18 years, and hearing from the age groupers of the world who do this not for magazine covers and money, but just for the love of the sport is really cool. So thank you, Rebecca, for taking the time. Thank you to her athlete, Nathan, for putting us in touch with each other. And I hope you enjoyed the interview. Let's roll. We're here with Rebecca Beaker-McKee. Awesome age group season here, Rebecca. Everyone should know that I've been following you and your progression over the last few years. Well, really not progression. You've been killing it at half Ironman, full Ironman distances for 4 years now. And it seems like last year, 2017, you peaked, you did something right. Why don't you talk about last year?
Well, last year was just amazing. And I really am still on cloud nine about it. And it feels surreal, to be honest. You know, you like, you take a step back and you think to yourself, what just happened? But I think the biggest key ingredient for me for 2017 was, and I'm knocking on wood right now, I don't know if you can hear me, is I made it through a year not injured.
I was wondering what the difference was, because you had, like, I was looking back in the last few years and you're always high in the rankings. Like 2016, you were 21st in age group, all world athlete. Year before, 2015 and 2014, 46th, coincidentally, both years, 13th the year before, 102nd the year before, and this year, first in the age group, 7th in the world overall. And I'm looking and like the races were kind of similar. It looked like your season was planned out similarly, but for one reason or another, yeah, bam, up to 7th.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've had hip issues, structural issues that unfortunately, I had a fairly aggressive coach back in, I would say probably the 2010 era, that really felt strongly that I needed to be running a different way. And the reality is that my structure just didn't really allow for that, but I tried really hard and I ended up really causing a lot of damage to my greater trunkantor, which everybody can go and look that up, but it's on the side of your hip.
And what was he trying to change, he or she?
Well, it was a man, and I have a whip kick. So my left femur is an inch shorter than my right femur, and it's actually been x-rayed, and the guys down at Boulder Sport, and I think it's BSCM. Actually, they're not around anymore. So anyways, I had it done in Boulder, and my left femur is an inch shorter than my right, but it's been like that since birth, obviously. And so honestly, I never knew it was an issue. And I learned how to walk from my knees down. My legs are actually kind of bowed out, but I'm knock-kneed. And when I run, I have a whip kick. Like if you're running to the right of me, I will probably kick you. And I've actually told people I wouldn't run there, you know? And
I can actually see that in your race photos on Instagram.
Right.
Yeah. Like your knees are tight, but your legs splay out, or your lower leg splays out, but your foot kind of comes in.
Correct. And if you actually see me on video, you know, I've had even Cliff, as my coach now, Cliff English, has said to me, I don't know how you move forward.
Yeah. How do you even stay upright?
Right. But of course, not having probably the best coach at that point, he felt really strongly that if I could, you know, land on my toes and I could get my legs under me, that I could go faster. And by doing that, I caused a bursitis, you know, a chronic bursitis in my right hip from trying to get my foot to kick out behind me rather off to the side. And, you know, when you start messing with your structure, it's not a good thing. I always tell my athletes, because I'm also a coach, I always tell my athletes, if there's nothing going on and there's nothing wrong with you, do not change it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if it's structurally an issue, I don't need to teach you to run like, you know, the fastest runners in the world. I need to teach you how to run like you so you can be faster.
Yeah. Well, Josh Amberger, he was on the podcast about a month ago, and he said that his coach has been getting him to actually heel strike. And I was like, what? Why is he working on getting me to heel strike? And he said, well, it's just more natural for me. I was working on being a 4-foot striker. And he's like, yeah, that's just what my structure wants to do. So I did a bunch of research after and did a YouTube video on it. And all the data says that whether you heel strike or 4-foot strike, it doesn't really matter. As long as long as you land under your center of gravity, you're good. So just do whatever's natural.
It's so infuriating to me to have, it's like the next fad, you know, somebody comes out and they're like, we should be running this way. And so everybody starts to run that way. It's just frustrating because obviously back in the day, we didn't have somebody telling me, you know, telling us we needed to run some way. We just ran, you know, if you watch children run, they run beautiful. Like, you know, they're out there running barefoot. They have perfect form for them, you know, but at some point we put shoes on our feet and we decide that we need to tell you how to run. So, you know, we all kind of know how to run. So that's kind of the big thing is that I kind of had to get over that hip injury. And then unfortunately, the end of 2014, I tore the labrum in my left hip and I did not want to have surgery. I spent all of 2015 trying to find an alternative to surgery and actually landed on the Stedman Clinic in Vail, Colorado and ended up having stem cell treatment done.
How did you find it? This is really interesting to me because you hear guys like Joe Rogan talking about it and he seems to say that it's the greatest thing. And I've got an injury right now in my Achilles that is historically an almost impossible thing to completely get over. And it makes me think like, I wonder if that would work.
Well, I will talk to you about that after the podcast, but I will tell you that I am actually very biased before we start. I actually work with the Stedman Clinic now. I've probably sent close to 70 people there on recommendation and referral for treatments. And there's not one person that has come out of treatment that has regretted it or that has not seen a positive impact. And all of them have come out that those that did not go in absolutely needing surgery, all of them have come out not having to have surgery and have returned to their sport. And it was very frustrating. I spent a lot of time researching. I'm kind of one of those people, I don't sit down and read novels. You know, I jump on websites and, you know, look at research papers and I just started researching stem cell and really became very consumed with it. I wouldn't even use the word obsessed because I wanted to be able to understand it, talk intelligently about it, and find a doctor that I could go and have this done with. It took me almost a year. I mean, I went in full circle because when I originally tore my labrum, I was referred to Stedman and I didn't want to have the surgery. And I had no idea they were doing stem cell. And so I kind of stumbled upon them accidentally almost a year later and was like, how come I didn't know you guys were doing this? And frustrated that it took me a year to figure it out. But also by the time I got back there, I really understood the procedures, the process, what it was going to do, what it could not do, what could be done legally in the United States versus what could be done in other countries. And I literally went in, I flew down on the 30th of December in 2015, had my hip done the 31st, drove back to Denver and flew home that night so that I was home in time for New Year's Eve. So the procedure is very quick. It's very easy. I would not recommend driving and flying the same day you have it done. You don't really feel that good, but I very much am so grateful that that's the route I went because 6 weeks later, I was running. 2 days after the procedure, the pain was gone. The chronic aching deep in the joint pain that you get with a labral tear or any kind of arthritis, all of that was definitely gone immediately. And so there's this really strange feeling of I'm cured within days of having it done. And you have to really be diligent about not buying into that because you have to allow the cells to attach and heal. But basically 6 weeks later, I was running and it was only, you know, so many minutes at a time, but I was running 720s.
Really?
And having to tell myself, you need to stop right now like I was running, not paying attention to the watch. You know, it's what I was told. They were just go out, run, take it easy. I felt so amazing. It just felt so good to run again and run without pain. And by the time I rolled into, you know, I did the Lava Man, which is a Olympic distance triathlon in Hawaii. That race happens the end of March, beginning of April. That was the first time I ran 6 miles. It was during the race. I mean, we just kind of went along for the ride for the year, you know, and then I did the half Ironman in Hawaii in 2016. And that was the first time I'd run 13 miles. You know, that race is the beginning of June. And, you know, I had Kona coming. And so we were really careful about how many races we did in 2016. And, you know, by the time I got to Kona, that was the first time I had ran over 18 miles. So 2016 kind of put me in this space of getting healed, getting myself back on track, being really focused and smart. But in May of 2016, I was biking on a rainy day here in Alaska, and I hit a landscaping hose that I did not see because I was watching for a car, and I tore the labrum in my shoulder. And actually, I think I'm off a year here, but at any rate, I end up going and having the shoulder done, and I'm out for the season. Basically, in 2016, I don't race Hawaii. I'm sorry. It's like all the years blend together. And we decide to focus on Australia, the 70.3 World Championships in Kona. But I'm still recovering and trying to get back on track with the shoulder. And, you know, the hip is great at this point. And I end up going back to Stedman after Ironman Arizona in 2016 and having the shoulder and the hip done again. And so basically I roll into 2017, not injured, because the stuff that I did the end of 2016 was preventative. And like they recommend doing it, the hip the second time. And I had not had the shoulder done by then. So does that all make sense? Was I just completely confusing there?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, this makes sense. So basically like, yeah, that's why you couldn't perform at your absolute best in 15, 16, 14, whatever it was, because you're
right.
I mean, you're racing banged up.
Right, exactly.
So this year, 2017, you, of the halves that I could see, St. Croix, Santa Rosa, Hawaii, Canada, all 70.3s there, going anywhere from 459 to 528, winning every age group, placing first in every age group besides Canada, where you were second.
Right. And I actually made some mistakes in Canada. I dropped my chain on the bike to the point that I had to get off my bike to fix it.
I did that in Austin.
Oh. Right. You're like, how did this happen?
Yeah. Oh, it feels like amateur hour. Like, what am I doing?
Right. Yeah. And I got lost on the swim to the extent that I had to stop and ask the girl next to me, where are we supposed to be? So we just had the sun at the wrong location and, you know, head down for too long, not sighting. And all of a sudden you're like, so we're swimming back to shore.
So you made it through all of 2017 injury free, like just trained, peaked when you needed to, rested when you needed to, like you were just racing, not battling, managing injuries.
Right. And we made a decision at the beginning of 2017, and that's my coach and my husband, that we would not target 70.3 World Championships, which hurt me a little bit mentally because I really feel that I could have been very competitive in that field. And obviously with my ranking here at the end of the year and how my 70.3 year went, it was a little bit bittersweet to not go. But with just age grouping up, we felt really strongly about a very strong finish in Kona and opted to take that time to do some really focused work for Kona. And so I didn't go to the 70.3 World Championships this year and opted to go to Kona instead. And I'm happy we did. I would have liked to have finished on the podium in Kona. Who doesn't want to finish on the podium in Kona? But, you know, to be as high as third and to land an eighth, it was still an amazing day.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to get to Kona. Do you find yourself that you're a hot weather racer? Because I look at,
yes,
look at St. Croix, Santa Rosa, Hawaii. Yeah. All your Instagram, I have to look and go like, does she live in Alaska or not? Because constantly in the beating sun sweating.
Right. So a couple of funny things there. It is kind of a joke about how much time I actually spend in Alaska. And I do really love being here, but I really don't enjoy the dark and I don't mind the cold as much, but the dark really kind of makes me crazy. But I do really, really like to be warm. And another thing that I've actually told some other people that have interviewed me, my body temperature is low. When I have my temperature taken, I'm like 97.4 to 97.6. And so I'm cold all the time. And being in warm weather, obviously, it's not as harsh on me as it might be on other individuals whose body temperature is a degree higher than mine. And so I find a real advantage in racing in the heat because I really enjoy being warm. But to kind of throw in a piece of funny, you can talk to probably hundreds of people that follow me all over the place. The big joke is that if you want to go to a race and you want the weather to be bad, show up where I show up. Because I have this thing about bringing bad weather with me. So it was not warm in Santa Rosa. It was really cold and I was really frustrated that it was so cold. And I actually had to put a hat on, gloves, a coat. You know, I rode with that the entire ride. And in Arizona, you'll see like my transitions were longer because I actually got out of the water and put socks on. I had toe warmers with heaters. I had I had gloves. I had hand warmers on my bike. Yeah, it's obnoxious. So I had arm warmers.
How much did people ask you why you were doing that? Because you're from Alaska. You're supposed to be able to tolerate that. Like when I went down to Austin, it was just above freezing. And everyone's saying, oh, you should be fine with this. I'm like, no, it's still just above freezing.
Freezing, right. Yeah,
it's still 3 degrees Celsius, like 39 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm bundling up. And they're like, oh, yeah, no, you're from Canada. You should be used to this. Like, no, it's still cold.
When you get out of the water, right, it's still cold. Absolutely. You know, it's probably one of the number one questions besides you and I were talking earlier. The next question you're always asked is, how do you train in that weather and how it, why are you so cold here? You should be warm.
Yeah, let's get into your training a little bit. I think that's the most fascinating thing that people would find interesting. So number one, you're in Alaska and don't have a ton of sunlight, don't have a ton of good weather. Number two, you own a performance center, Peak Center Alaska, doing sports science and coaching. Number three, you're an awesome age group athlete. How do you balance it all? Can you give me a run through of what a typical training week looks like and whether you're doing it, let's say if you're going to say that you're doing a run, are you doing it on a treadmill or indoors or outdoors or a bike? Like, what does that look like week to week?
Well, I think this is a great question actually, because I talk to balance in your life all the time, but I think, you know, we always talk about these things, but do we really do them that well personally? You know, I think I actually have a pretty good balance of getting it all in. But I will say that I always make my training the priority. So when I sit down and lay out my schedule for my lab, because I do, you know, I own a metabolic lab, I do VO2 max testing, lactate analysis, metabolic analysis, I do all kinds of sport testing, you know, people come into the lab. When I sit down to lay out my lab schedule, I put my workouts on my schedule first. And I've actually always done this even before I owned my lab. You know, back in the day when I worked in the engineering world, my schedule always went on my calendar before other. And I think I learned this a long time ago from a really good friend of mine who was an amazing athlete himself. And he told me, he said, people will take your time and they will never give it back to you and you will never get it back. You always have to take time for yourself first if you want to have time for yourself. And so I kind of block it out in my day. Like, this is an appointment to me. This is my commitment to me. This is a commitment to my mental well-being, my mental health, my physical well-being, my physical health. And when I take care of myself, I'm capable of maintaining the balance of everything else. And I'm capable of being the best coach I can be. I'm capable of being the best wife I can be, the good friend, you know, all of those things. But when I don't take care of myself, I can't do all of it. So that's the first thing. My training actually comes first. And then, you know, when you ask questions about how I'm going to train and things like that, there's a lot of opportunity. We were talking about this earlier as well, to train outside, even in cold weather. But I do have a weather limit. You know, I won't run when it's icy out. I am terrified of falling. And so I spent a lot of time on the treadmill. We also have a dome here in Alaska. The roof of it collapsed last year and they literally just reopened it. But I spent a lot of time running circles in that dome on days that I just can't stand the thought of being on the treadmill. But a lot of trainer riding, obviously pool swimming. We also ride our fat bikes. You know, we have snow winter bikes, and when the weather's right or the conditions are good, we'll get out and ride outside and to be outside so we're not too insane.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just did my first fat bike ride a couple weeks ago. Loved it. Do you find that that helps with triathlon?
Yeah, so much, because first off, riding on the fat bike takes a totally different type of strength. It's a 6 mile an hour, 9 mile an hour adventure. And it takes a lot of different use of the muscles because of the way the fat bikes are set up. And also we can't customize fat bikes the way we customize all of our fantastic road bikes and TT bikes and things like that. So you kind of end up with different crank lengths and it kind of just puts you in a different space. I think it's kind of like a good comparison to just be a different type of cross training, but as long as you're not out there hammering and you're just allowing your muscles to move in certain patterns, they're just patterned off enough from how you normally ride. And you know, one of our biggest problems as triathletes is we have chronic overuse injuries because we do the same repetitive patterns over and over. And so I think that being on a bike that fits a little bit different and the mechanics of it are a little bit different and it takes a different type of aerobic energy to ride it, that it's a great cross training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something I've mentioned a couple times in some videos lately, because we're doing a lot of, like, I call it overall cycling depth fitness lately, where we're doing tons of lower gear work at like 65 and then a bunch at 110 and like building yourself as an overall cyclist.
Absolutely.
Not just a time trialist. Cause yeah, like you say, that's how you get injured. That's how you get burnt out. That's how you become, I would say, fit in one specific aspect of cycling. And then all of a sudden you get out into a race and you're redlining it and you got to take a corner and you haven't used your obliques in 6 months.
Right. That's exactly what it is. And you know, the other thing too is big muscle versus small muscle, right? In the TT position, we're using our, you know, the glutes, the quads, we're using these big muscles, hamstrings, but our smaller muscles aren't being utilized as much because of the position that we're in. And when those big muscles fatigue, what muscle group is pulled in? Your smaller muscles. But if they're not trained, that's where your injuries happen, right? That's the weakest link. And so being in these other positions, like you're saying, doing different cadence drills, you know, working on hills, things like that, being upright, those work that those different muscle structures.
Mm-hmm. So how many hours are you getting in a week, do you figure?
On a heavy week or just a general week for me?
Let's go with a general week, and what do you build up to?
Well, I probably don't train any less than 12 hours in a week. And, you know, I'm kind of in off season right now and just starting to ramp back up. And so it's probably, you know, right around 12-ish. And as I'm starting to ramp up here, it goes to about 15. And then I would say at the very, very most, my very heaviest weeks of the year might hit around 21, but those are unique weeks. You know, those are weeks where I've gone out and done an override, where I've ridden 115 miles or, you know, have run long and done an override. We don't do a lot of really heavy weeks. And I'm not really a proponent of you need to do so many hours. I really believe in the quality of what you're doing within your hours. And so luckily for me, my coach also feels that way. And, you know, we change what we're doing. So maybe it's an hour workout, but now that hour workout has a different focus.
So like, can you describe what that would mean? Like, what does that mean in practical terms?
Okay. So right now, this time of year, because my first race of the season is an Olympic distance race, and I purposely put this Olympic distance race as the first race of the year for two really important reasons. Number one important reason, it's in Hawaii. That's the number one important reason. And there can't be any other important reason. And the second reason is because it forces me to do speed work and to work on intensity before I really get into my endurance season. And yes, we as endurance athletes still do intensity and we still do speed work, but I'm not going to be running the paces that I'm running in a half Ironman that I run in an Olympic distance race. And I'm not going to be doing the cycling watts and things like that that I'm doing in a half Ironman or Ironman. And I really wish I could say that I was one of those badasses that can do that stuff. And I don't like to use age as an excuse, but I'm 45 and I absolutely have learned that I am not going to ride the watts that I ride in an Olympic distance race in a half Ironman or a full. And so this time of year, I'll have workouts where, you know, I do a 15-minute warm-up in my zone one. And then I'm doing, you know, interval work where 6 by 30 seconds on the 2 minute, where the 30 seconds ramp up to a max out interval. And I'm doing 6 by 3 minute efforts of low cadence, like you were talking about. And then going to a very high cadence, but still holding a fairly good amount of watts. And then so many minutes recovery. And, you know, they're all very short intervals and we do a number of them and then we have a decent amount of cool down and done for the day. But let's say the middle of April, May, that same hour workout looks like 20 minutes of warm up and a 20 minute effort at a zone three and 20 minutes cool down. So it's still got some intensity into it, but it's not this VO2 max and high watt interval, high recovery cycle that we're doing right now. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Because in my experience, how we've designed my training, what I've found, even when I didn't have a coach, was the speed takes a long time to work on and the strength takes a long time to work on. But then endurance, I don't know, frankly, with like 8 weeks of good endurance training, you can really quickly build up to being right. able to hit that zone three, just chug it out for 4 hours.
Right. And this builds on itself as you become, and I say this, we have our sport age, right? As you become an older triathlete, not necessarily your real age, but your sport age, your endurance base just continues to build. And it doesn't take as long to get back to that endurance base. I mean, I'm 18 years old as a triathlete. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I recognized, you know, let's say I get sick and I'm down for a week and a half and, you know, I can't run. There used to be that anxiety and paranoia of, oh my gosh, you know, I haven't been able to run for 7 days or I'm going on 14 days now where, you know, I still can't run without coughing. And, you know, you have this dialogue in your head of, I'm losing fitness. Now I'm like, you know what? I'm going to take 3 days off. I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to get rid of this. So by the time I hit 5 days, I can get back to my training instead of doing what I used to do where I was like, well, I feel a little better. I'm going to run and my, you know, my cold would be extended every day for 2 days because of trying to do something, but also absolutely having confidence there and that it doesn't take that much to jump off and get back into it.
How'd you get into it originally?
This is a funny story. And I've told it many times, so maybe people have heard it before, but I had a girlfriend back in 2000 talked me into doing a triathlon because maybe you're asking about triathlon. I was kind of in and out of sport as a kid, but nothing organized and just, you know, I used to ride my bike with the boys and things like that, but I was never in sport as a kid. And in 2000, a girlfriend of mine talked me into doing a race here in Alaska called the Gold Nugget Triathlon. And it is the longest running all women's triathlon in the nation. And it actually sells out in about 8 minutes. They let 1,500 women into it now. And it's a really big deal here in Anchorage. And we've actually seen people come from other states and other countries to do it too now, which is pretty cool. But it's a sprint triathlon. It's a 500-yard swim in the pool. It tends to be 11 to 14 miles on the bike and anywhere from 3 to 4 miles running, depending on how the course has been laid out because various years we've had to change it. And the first year I did this race, I swam over 12 minute 500. I had to hold on at the end of the pool many times. I was pretty confident I might die. And, you know, I got out. I don't even remember what my bike was. I rode a mountain bike that I borrowed and I did the 33-minute 3-mile run. And I was so excited that my name was in the newspaper. And I think, you know, I finished maybe top 100, 200. I mean, I was not under 100. It was like, you know, somewhere in the 1 to 200 range, but there's probably only, you know, 300 women in this race at this point. So, you know, it was definitely on the back half, but I crossed that finish line and I have never been so proud of myself in my whole life. I mean, I did this whole thing all by myself with no training really, besides, you know, getting in a pool a couple of times, and I completely caught the triathlon disease. I crossed that finish line and I knew I would never look back. I knew that this was going to be something that probably was going to consume me. And I also knew that I wanted to get better. And in 2004, I started a triathlon club here in Alaska with another guy, a couple of other guys, but myself and another guy are still heavily involved on the board of directors for the club. And we, you know, kind of became coaches overnight. And at that point in time, I probably shouldn't have been coaching people. I was just trying to figure out, you know, what to do and when to do it. And then it just, everything, you know, just spilled from there. I did my first half Ironman in 2004. And a couple of years ago here, I went back and finished second overall woman in that event, the Gold Nugget. And I'm really beaming proud of that, because I feel like, especially for women, you know, here I came to this sport and I wasn't a top athlete. I didn't really know how to swim. I didn't have a fancy bike. I was not somebody that ran faster than 11 minute miles. And I just followed my heart and my passion and really had this dream, you know, look at 2017, which, believe me, I will never forget 2017. So it's just been, it's really amazing to look back, and I hope it inspires people. I hope people look at it and say, it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how slow you are. It doesn't matter how fast you are. It doesn't matter what my bike looks like. It doesn't matter if I don't have fancy fill in the blank. All that matters is if you have this desire and a passion and you find happiness in it, to just go out there and do it. And that's definitely something triathlon has given me. And it's just an amazing feeling. So that story of how I started and then coming back to the space and who I am today is just, it's inspiring to me to think about it.
Do you remember what it was in those first few races that hooked you? Like, was there a specific race or a moment or a feeling that you can think back to and go, you know what, that was what got me?
Absolutely, I can, because I actually give little talks on this. It was the feeling of crossing the finish line. That is the most amazing feeling in the world. I don't know too many feelings, maybe eating cake, you know, that come close to the internal feeling of achievement, the feeling of, I started this morning and I put this challenge ahead of me. And in the beginning it was, can I even do this? Am I going to really be able to do all of this together today and make it to this finish line? And now, you know, that drive is a little bit different, obviously, because I go to races with a very different purpose now, but it's still getting across the finish line. One of the things I always want to say when I cross the finish line is, that was everything I had today. I gave it all that I had, and I did the best that I could do with what the day handed me and with the mistakes that I made and with the challenges that I faced. When I cross the finish line, I am very, I will say, there are very few times that I have ever felt, in fact, there's never. I have never crossed a finish line and felt disappointment. I have never crossed a finish line and said to myself, what if, or if I could have. But I will say that I've crossed and said to myself, that's not going to happen again. Like when I crossed the finish line in Kona and had a couple of days, I was like, that is never happening to me again. And that is why when I went to Arizona, you know, when things started to fall apart on me, kind of getting off top, I started to have stomach issues at mile 21 and I had to take an Imodium, and I'm trying to open this Imodium and run and I'm panicking and I dropped my Imodium on the ground.
Subtle, very subtle, because nobody's going to notice that.
Right. And I was like, you are going to find that. You are not going to keep running. And I think, you know, a mistake I would have made in the past is, fine, just go. It's only 5 more miles. But I found that. And let me tell you, that's the reason I crossed the finish line. So, you know, it's like the mistakes you make in the past come back and haunt you. only if you don't learn from them, right?
You know, I am sitting with a pillow that is shaped like a poop emoji, and I've got a poop emoji coffee mug 5 feet away from me. But for the sake of the world, we're going to end at the finish line. I won't dig on that because you're a lady and you don't deserve that.
Right. But yeah, when things go sideways in a race, you have to have your mental capacity to think, well, how do I fix this? And that's where I'm always at. And so I think that feeling of, I made it through today. I made it through with everything that was thrown at me. I did the very best I could have done, and I'm crossing the finish line. And it's a really awesome feeling. I know everybody that's crossed the finish line has to understand this feeling right now. Like, maybe I can't put it into complete words, but it's just, you did it. I did it. I made it here. You know, of all the hurdles in my life and all the things that were thrown at me today in this race and all my ups and downs, I made it to this line, you know?
It's an exclamation point. Yeah.
Right.
I actually don't know the backstory to this at all. I just know it from your Instagram profile. You've overcome cancer in your life. When did you go through that? And how does it play into your motivation to keep crossing those finish lines?
Well, I was diagnosed with adenocarcinoma of the cervix back in 2001, which at that point in time was a really rare form of cervical cancer. And it was an actual tumor. We didn't know a lot about cervical cancers that created tumors. And so I guess in a certain way, you know, so many people have this story, by the way, you know, I don't ever take a lot of motivation from my cancer story, because I feel like I don't let this story define who I am. But on a certain level, I was kind of lucky, because the timing of it and my age allowed me access to some of the very best doctors in the nation, because they wanted to study me. And because of that, I got really great attention quickly, and everything was cleared up very fast. I did not have to do chemo. I did not have to go through radiation. I had a 3/4 colonization of the cervix. So they basically cut out 3/4 of my cervix. And, you know, they've since learned a lot about this cancer, and it's still scary. It's so very scary to have somebody sit down and tell you, you have cancer, and to hear those words and the thought process that goes through your mind. And you go home and everything's different. You appreciate the color of that leaf on the tree, and you really enjoy how cake tastes, and you cry, and you're angry, and, you know, you think, why me? And you find this space of like unconditional love, and you kind of come to terms with, wow, where is this going to lead me? And, you know, I'm not a real religious person, so I didn't have, you know, the whole like praying and all those things, but I did the one thing that I knew was going to help me mentally. And that was, I got outside. And every single time I went out, I said to myself, I'm going to make the most of this moment. I'm going to notice that ladybug. And I'm not even exaggerating here. Like, these are real memories that I'm sharing with you right now. I'm going to take a minute and I'm going to take a picture of this dragonfly, and I'm going to look at all the colors. And it was just this real, like, oh my gosh, it just punched me in the gut. And it made me ask myself, what is time worth? You know, what is time worth? And that's one of those things, that conversation I told you earlier about scheduling for me first, that came from a conversation with an athlete who was also a therapist that said, here's another way for you to get through this. Make your time for you important to you, and always do you first. And so it definitely drives me even to this day. I don't ever want to hear those words again. And I recently had another scare with some abnormal cells and having to deal with all of that. And everything's fine. But, you know, having that replay, you're just kind of like, I really want to make the most of every moment.
Did that lead to you doing your first race?
Well, I had already done a triathlon at that point.
Okay.
But I was just a dabbler, and I knew I was going to be involved in triathlon. I knew that I was going to be, you know, like I said, the story earlier, I knew that it was going to change my life, but I definitely didn't have any idea that I would be where I am today. I mean, you know, I think everybody that's ever seen the Iron Man on TV, you know, I was a little kid, watched the crawling across the finish line, you know, that movement in your heart. And how can anybody watch that and not be like gut wrenched by it? And, you know, I always thought I'd like to do that race someday, but I never understood what that race was. And I think, you know, after the cancer and after I was able to like get back on track and get back to exercising, I don't think it like led completely to where I am today, because I was already in triathlon at that point. But I think what it did was made me take the opportunity that I had to be healthy and exercise to a different level. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. The, what you talk about with like doing you first, I think that's really rare. And like, it almost sounds foreign when I hear it. I mean, I totally get it. I schedule out probably 3/4 of my day as me time, whether it's working out or meditating, or this is the stuff that I'm going to do today. And maybe just 1/4 is all right. People are allowed to take some of my time through email or meetings or whatever it is. So I get it. I totally get it. But I think it's so foreign that, at least it's foreign enough that I'm trying to practice it. And I hear you say it, and I'm like, oh, that just sounds different. And I think people can understand that their life is whatever they make of it if they put themselves first. It doesn't have to be just bouncing off of the walls that life is throwing at you.
Well, and this is a really touchy subject on some levels, because people hear that and they think, what a selfish thing. Or they think, you know, well, I can't do that because I have kids. I have this job. I'm a doctor. I'm this. I mean, I work with athletes, and I got to tell you, the range of reasons why people don't put themselves first. First off, they believe them. They're very real. They're all valid. And second, they come from this space of like guilt or shame, or they're a bad person. And what I like to try to do with people when I have this conversation with them, and the hurdle I jumped many, many, many years ago now, is if you aren't healthy, if you aren't happy, if you aren't physically well, emotionally well, you can't do any of that other stuff. And you can try to fake it and you can move through your life unconsciously and not take that time. And let me tell you what, every single one of us are going to be faced with the day of looking back, you know, whether it comes in seconds or you have months to think about it, the end is the same, and we're all going to get there. So, you know, how you want to live your day every single day, absolutely your choice. But if you do it from a space of never taking care of yourself, it isn't selfish. It's about really, truly being the best you for all the other things you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you've spent your entire life just playing whack-a-mole with the next email and the next meeting and the next committee that you've been asked to be on, but you haven't really taken time for yourself, and maybe you do want to be on a committee, but you're on 17 other committees or whatever it is. But
right.
Yeah.
And then this is just hyper. The United States is probably the only place that does this. Maybe you guys do it as well. But I mean, there's countries that like shut down in the middle of the day, every single day.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, the afternoon siesta.
Right.
I think there's more countries that probably do an afternoon siesta than ones that have average work weeks of 45 hours.
That's right. You know, and I actually believe that is very true, that there's statistics out there that prove it, and they have healthier people, happier people, you know, check all the boxes, right?
Yeah. Let's get back to triathlon a little bit.
Okay.
Last couple of questions. Sorry to take it like deep dark there. I didn't mean to do
that. No, I'm okay with it. I just always think to myself, how much have I been talking? I warned you, I talk a lot.
An appropriate amount so far.
Me.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'll tell you when we're running out of tape.
All right. Perfect.
So you're a coach, but you still have a coach. Do you want to explain to the typical age grouper who might not understand why that is?
Well, I'll tell you, the first reason is, even though I truly believe in putting that time down for me and making sure I do these things, when I am left to my own devices, it's easy for me to say, okay, I've got that hour run to do, but I should do X, Y, and Z. And I can still get that hour run done at 3:00. And then 3:00 rolls around and, oh, you know what? Okay, let me just finish this last thing. But when I have somebody I need to be accountable to, I'm kind of like, I don't want Cliff to see that I didn't do my workout today, you know? And so that's one of the reasons. Another reason is that I am one of those people that kind of needs to be told no, because I will go and go and go. And so I have athletes like that, and I love them. They're probably my favorite type of athlete, but they're also the hardest to coach because you feel like you're telling them no all the time. And I just kind of need somebody to oversee, I call it oversee the attention span of Becky, and and to recognize that I might really want to do 15 races this month, but you really shouldn't let me. And I might, I'm totally exaggerating, but
I sure hope so.
But, you know, or I might want to go and add in an extra bike ride, another run, another this. But when I have somebody that's overseeing my plan, I don't need to think to myself, I should be doing more or I need to do more, because I know this person is taking care of what I need to be doing. And the final thing, which I think is probably maybe the most important, is that when Cliff English said he would coach me, I literally wrote him a check and handed it to him. And when he took it, I said, you are under contract. And if you don't continue to coach me from this point forward, that's breaking a contract, because you're kidding, right? This guy's amazing. And we were just generally talking, and he was like, I'd probably coach you. And I was like, well, what would that run be? You know, and I'm talking to him about it and like literally hand him a check. And before we even get any further, I'm like, so you took the check. That's a contract. You're stuck.
You can't take, yeah, no take backs, no take backs.
Right? He's like, I haven't cashed it. I'm like, that's legal. You touched it.
Yeah, that verbal contract, and there's an exchange of currency. Yeah, done.
Right. And so, you know, I had really heavy, high goals, and I had given up on those goals, which is something that I haven't talked about with you. But in 2010, I kind of just gave up. I just kind of knew I was never going to make it to Kona. And I'd been trying to do it through the 70.3 venues, because at that time you could still go via 70.3. And also I had a lot of anxiety about going longer because of my structural issues. And I just wanted to race Kona once because of my love for the island. And I used to kid around that if they would just move the world championships and let me do my Ironman in Kona, my life would be complete. It wasn't so much that I wanted to do the world championships. It's that I really wanted to race there. I have a really special connection with the island. It really means a lot to me. And I really wanted to race there, but I had given up on trying to get there. And so when I was lucky enough to cross paths with Cliff in Kona and then build a relationship with him that put him in the position of making the mistake of offering to coach me.
Sucker.
I took full advantage of that.
So what was it that pulled you out of that funk in 2010, turned it around?
Well, I have to tell you, it had a lot to do with Cliff. When I met him and we moved into him coaching me in 2012, he just gave me confidence. Like, I just was so excited that somebody like him believed in me. And between him and my husband, I kind of got, like, I don't want to use the word bullied or tricked, but somehow I ended up signing up for Ironman Whistler in 2013. And really, my husband came home and he's like, so I signed up for Whistler today. And I was like, what are you talking about? You don't do triathlon. You don't do Ironman. What do you, you know, it's just like, you can't do an Ironman without me. And yeah. So I think between 2012, I started hitting the podium almost immediately working with Cliff. We made some changes. And from there, going to Whistler to do my first Ironman, which, by the way, took me 13 years to do my first Ironman. When I got to Whistler, we kind of had some things going for us. And I think that also kind of changed my idea of being able to make it to Kona, because luckily they put 100 slots in that race. And I was like, I just have to finish in the top six, you know, at this race in my age group. And maybe that could happen. And this is a funny story that I probably haven't told. And I was so anxious about my first Ironman, to think that I'd done 30 plus halves and been racing for 13 years by that point. And I kept talking to Cliff and asking him, I'm like, well, what if it takes me 12 hours? What if it takes me 14 hours? You know, I must have been making him insane. And at one point he said to me, if you're on the course longer than 13 hours, I don't care where you're at. You just walk off the course and take a cab to the finish.
To get you in under 14, of course. Yeah.
Well, no, I think he just meant quit. Something's wrong. You know, he was like, something is wrong if you aren't at the finish line by then. And so every time I talk to him, I'm like, well, what do you think I can do? You know, and I think about how well he handled me, and it definitely taught me a lot as a coach, because I don't allow my athletes that do their first Ironmans to do this time game because it makes you insane. But I remember talking to him the morning before the race, and we talked about what was going to happen. And basically I said, well, you know, I just want to come in on my first Ironman under 12, but I'm going to let the day happen and blah, blah, blah. Hang up the phone. That night, I spent that day thinking, I got all my stuff together. You know, I did my little process that I do before I race. That night, before I went to bed, about 9:40 p.m. Whistler time, I called Cliff and left this message on his voicemail. And I said, hey, you know that bullshit that I was talking to you about over the last couple of weeks where I've just been this insane athlete that you don't want to coach anymore? I just need you to realize I'm totally okay. And I'm going to go about 10:40 tomorrow, and I'm going to fucking qualify. And that's going to be that. And I hung the phone up. Sorry about swearing. And he told me when he got that voicemail the next morning that he had a complete breakdown. He was just like, oh God, Becky, what are you doing? And he said he was so glued to the tracker the whole day because he didn't know where this came from. And that here I'd been so stressed out about finishing under 12, and all of a sudden I'm like, I'm going to go 10:40. And I ended up crossing the line in 10:43 and finishing second and qualifying for Kona. And so all of my voicemails for him, literally, I saved them for years until I can't remember, but are literally just him screaming. And I can't understand him at all. And he's just like over the moon excited. So it's just kind of funny to think that I'd had this massive anxiety all the way up to basically the minute I went to bed. And then I just had this calm, and I was just kind of like, what are you doing? You're fine. You are going, you know what you're doing. You know what you can do. Go do it.
How many times have you been to Kona now since then?
I have been to Kona 4 times. So I made it in 2013 at Whistler and went in 2013. And then in 2014, I signed up for Whistler again, but it was the last year that they had slots at the Hawaii 70.3. And I ended up getting a slot at the 70.3. And here I'd been trying all these years to get a slot. And I ended up finishing third that year. And the girl in first already had a slot. And the girl in second already had a slot. That just never happened. And so the slot rolled to me. And I did not do Whistler that year. My only Ironman in 2014 was Kona. And then in 2015, I went back to Whistler, and it was the year with the really crummy weather. And I had DI2 problems, but truth be told, I don't know if I would have finished that day. I could not function. And when the DI2 went out on my bike, it was just the final straw for me.
Yeah, that was
so
a
brutal
day.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who's now... last year was her first year as a pro. She didn't even finish. Like, I don't even think she made the bike finish. I think she hauled herself off the course like 30 miles from the end. It was so cold.
Yeah, I made it to Callahan and my DI2 went out, and I'd been nursing it and trying to figure out what was going on and just standing around trying to figure out how to fix it. You know, the medic kept asking me what my race number was. I kept telling him my name. I mean, I had no idea where I was. They were not going to let me go. You know, that poor man, I probably cried like you can't even imagine. I'm still embarrassed to this day how hard I cried when they told me they weren't going to let me get back on my bike. And there was no way I was getting back on my bike. Like, no way. I could not physically stop shaking. But I went and did Ironman Arizona in 2015. And qualified for Kona in 2016. And so I did Kona in 2016, which was my third one. I did Arizona again and qualified for 2017. And then I did Kona this year and then did Arizona again this year, and I qualified for 2018. So I've actually done Kona more than any other Iron Man.
Ooh, there's a feather in your cap.
It's kind of pretty cool. I'm kind of proud of it.
Yeah. Well, you said that Kona has a special place in your heart. I think you and 100,000 other people, like, it's just such a magical place. In your words, what does it mean?
Well, we've been visiting the island since 2002, and it's just, I don't know. I think you either just really love being on the big island or you don't. And being there is just really spiritual for me. And racing there has always been really important to me and special. And I think some of it has to do with, it is so hard. It is a very hard place to race. I really, truly feel anyone that races there and how you finish there, it's so legitimate. It's not a fast course. It's not an easy course. There's no easy day. And no matter what race you're doing there, you know, the Lava Man, the Honu, they have an amazing community there that puts on all kinds of really fun local events. I go over and race the local events. I find any excuse to get on an airplane to go there. And I think that sitting on the beaches and hearing the ocean and being on the highway and riding your bike and running the road, I mean, man, there's no words to explain this. It's just this intense feeling of, this is where I belong. And when you really get to know the people there and, you know, the store owners and the community, the race community, the sport community there, like, it really is family. I feel like the people that I know there and spend time with are my family. And I think when you really learn about the culture and you really learn about Ireland, and yeah, it's hard to put into words, but it's just such an amazingly special place. And then to have that feeling and then go and have an opportunity to race in the world championships, to race the very best in the world. And that's always very exciting to me. I truly believe, and for anybody listening, if you ever have a chance to go to a world championship, go. Don't tell yourself, I don't deserve it, or I'm not fast enough, or whatever it is. I mean, to race against the best in the world only makes you better. And I have such a huge respect for the women that I race against. And I understand the sacrifices the sport take, you know, that we make to be in the sport. And especially as age groupers, I mean, we're not getting paid. You know, it really has to be this amazing passion that keeps you doing the sport day after day, because it does take so much. And there's just so much that it takes to get to that start line in Kona and to be ready for that day. And the whole day is just, you know, I think to myself, I would rather not be anywhere else in the world but here suffering, you know?
If you're going to suffer anywhere, you might as well suffer in Kona.
Right. You know? And I think I'm just going to put the exclamation point on this because I'm not doing the best job of explaining it. I think when you see the sun set into the ocean there.
Yeah.
And you just stand there and you take it in. That feeling is unmatchable. And that's just the exclamation point to my spiritual connection to that place.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something about it that is, it's hard to describe, but it just has a vibe to it that even if the race wasn't there, that it would still have this like a low hum of serenity, but power. And then combine that with being on the course and challenging yourself in probably one of the most difficult physical days that you'll ever have in your life against the best in the world on at a time that a bunch of people are having the most difficult physical day of their life. And they've sacrificed not just once to get there, but twice to qualify as well. That, yeah, it's our favorite week. I've never raced it, but we've been there twice to watch. And it's where Kim fell in love with the sport, my wife. It's where it kind of solidified, or I started understanding why NBC makes it out to be this magical place. And Mike Riley talks about it all the time, and everyone talks about it all the time. You don't really know until you've been there what it's like.
Well, first off, I'm going to steal what you just said for the next time somebody asks me to explain this, because that was absolutely perfect.
I stole that off of the back of a fortune cookie.
It was on the Wheaties box.
Yeah, yeah. I said Serenity. I don't even know what it means. It was a girl I went to high school with.
So awesome. So awesome. And no. And secondly, don't you believe that you will be no other place in the world but in Kona every year for this event now that you have been there? Like, if you have any way possible to be there, won't you be there?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, this right. year, this has been talked to death in podcasts and videos that I've done since going there. But when we went there in 2013, it was for our honeymoon. And it was this right. thing that we did off to the side of like saving up a little bit of money and having the time for it. And I was an investment advisor at the time, not super happy doing it. And Kona was where I felt alive. And then this year, this past year, to be able to go back and that it now is life and that we're right. able to go there with work and potentially maybe think about qualifying someday because I'm getting faster.
Right.
And seeing the records be broken and like actually being in behind the scenes, right in behind the finish line with a camera and being able to document it and have that video for the rest of my life. Like when I need a pump up video to watch on the treadmill, I'll still watch that. Of the 95,000 views, I think I'm like 94,000 of them.
Right.
Yeah, you understand it now. And yeah, fight like hell to be able to get back every year.
My first year there was 2010. And I knew when I left that I would never not be on that island, whether I was racing or not, that I will be there every year for that event.
Oh, so you've gone there more than four times, but you've raced four times and then you just go yes. and hang out?
Yep. I was there in 2015 when I didn't qualify. I was there in 2010. The first year I was there for the race, I went for a coaching certification. And then I went back in 2011. I went back. That's when I met Cliff, actually. I was there in 2012. And that between 2011 and 2012 was kind of when I had that spirit of, and I was working with Cliff in 2012. I was like, I think I can get back here. You know, I had a conversation with him in Kona that year and definitely changed everything. And I just think that being there and being exposed to the athletes that go there and understanding their commitment and, you know, you kind of look at them as like these gods and goddesses of our sport. And, you know, you see them as these chiseled people and you're like, I'll never be that fit. But when you sit down and have conversations with them, they're you and me. You know,
they've just got more abs. Yeah.
Right.
It's wild. I do my runs down Ali'i Drive and like around town, I'm kind of fit. And then I go to Kona. I'm like, oh my God, I am out of shape here. Whoa.
I think if you ask every triathlete in Kona, like their biggest anxiety of the week, it's that they feel fat. You know? You're like, I don't want to stand next to this girl in the coffee line. And I mean, I never think about that stuff, but in Kona, I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah. You know? Oh yeah. There's 70-year-old dudes with 8-packs running around down there, like everywhere.
I was doing a training run and I had paces I was supposed to be holding. And I kid you not, this man comes by me. I'm trying to keep up with him a little bit, talk to him. Cause I'm one of those people that's like, hey, what are you doing? Are you doing the race? You know, just chatting it away. 63. Finally, I was like, you know, I got to let you go. I'm running like a minute and a half too fast here per mile, so I'm just gonna let you go. I saw the guy like 15 miles later. I'm like, are you kidding?
Still going. Yeah, well, right. I think that's something that I forget who said it, but we interviewed somebody with that week while we were there, and they're like, yeah, you can walk up and down Ali'i Drive and there are people blowing themselves up on a training run here to get those yep. last few miles in. I don't know why they feel they still need to do that. But because it's Kona, you've got a few hundred people yep. that are going to go and blast out an 18 miler at like 6-minute pace and then be thrashed for the race. It's a weird place. Like it makes people do funny things.
It does. And I'll tell you, this is probably not the nicest thing that I'll ever say. But one of my favorite things when I see those people is I hope she's in my age group.
You're right.
That I'm like, you go, nicest. Girl, you're not going fast
yeah.
enough.
Yeah, another 30 seconds. You can do it. Yeah. What are the plans this year to get back there? Like, where are you going to try to qualify?
Well, I have actually already qualified.
What?
I won
really?
Iron. Yeah. I won Ironman Arizona, oh. my age group.
Oh,
so, yeah. So I'm super excited. It was a really exciting day. And that qualified me for 2018. And I'm over the moon that I'm qualified already. And it, you know, kind of, you talk about exclamation points, our whole conversation, that was a massive exclamation point on the end of the year. It's the first Ironman that I have won my age group in. And it came at the end of a year that I didn't think could get any better, you know? So to come out of Kona in eighth and then, you know, turn around and cross the finish line in Arizona with the age group win was phenomenal and just super exciting. So I kind of had a fun year planned. I'm going to do Lava Man. And then I have never done an open marathon. And because why would anybody want to run that far? But I qualified for Boston in Kona in 2016. And so I was like, well, you know, maybe I should do the Boston Marathon as my one and only marathon. And so I'm going to go do Boston. And it's just, I don't know if you can ever say it's just going to be a fun day, but I truly am going to try to just be like, oh my gosh, I'm running the Boston Marathon and take pictures and, you know, talk to people and try to have a good time with it. And also my qualifying time put me in like the very last wave. So I'm kind of going to be forced to just take it easy. And then I'm headed to France. I'm doing the 70.3 in France and taking a little side biking trip to Tuscany and then headed to Hawaii 70.3. And then I'm actually going to be at Coeur d'Alene this year, 70.3. And then I've kind of got a fuzzy chunk of time because I qualified for the 70.3 World Championships at Whistler, 70.3. And we're trying to sort out how to get there. And I got to tell you, it is not easy. We are having a hard time finding flights that work and schedules that work. And because I'm going to head to Kona on the 15th of September to be there for Ironman Kona. And then I'm signed up for Arizona again.
Mm, yeah, that's a tricky turnaround there with South Africa. Like I'll be there.
It is.
I'll be there.
Oh, cool.
But, yeah, I ended up qualifying in Austin, but like the flights are going to be damn near $2,000 and we have to do at least three of
them. Yeah. Have you looked at it?
Haven't booked them yet, but I don't even have a turnaround to worry about. You got to worry about a good turnaround to get to Hawaii and not be thrashed for it.
Right. And also it's 3 days of traveling each direction to get there. And so I've actually even been kicking around, like flying from there right to Kona because it's the same amount of time to go. It's like 3 more hours to get to Kona versus coming back to Alaska kind of thing. But the problem is that even though I spend a lot of time in Kona, I actually have a storage unit there. I leave a lot of stuff there. It's a totally different race in South Africa. It's a cold weather race. So you need different gear. You know, I don't need to drag a wetsuit and all the other stuff. And I can't ride my disc in Kona. So I'm in this state of like, oh, I'm going to have to come home to just change gear.
Mm, yeah. You got to switch out like your setup.
Right. But we'll have to keep in touch on what you end up doing because we're like going to spend the night in Dubai. And yeah, anyways, blah, blah, blah.
I think that's the way to do it. So you can get the fancy planes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But for all of you out there that are trying to get to South Africa, I feel your pain because we're having a tough time sorting it out from Alaska, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, same thing from Winnipeg. It's just going to be a total money pit for us.
Yeah. I'm just like, how much do I really want to spend to do this?
I want to start being conscious of your time here. We could chat about Kona for ages. Who are your sponsors this coming year? Let's give them a shout out. Make sure that they get some love.
Yeah, well, Blue 70 has been with me since the beginning, and I really love those guys. They've taken good care of me and truly appreciate all the support they've given me over the years. I'm also working with Squirt Lube, a new company for me, but I can't say enough awesome about them. They actually have a chain lube that's pretty kick-ass, but I truly think that their barrier balm is one of the most amazing products ever created on the planet, and it's basically a chamois butter that just works amazing for shaping. You can use it on your neck, your feet, all of your parts. It's really good stuff. And then Torhans has helped me out a little bit here and there. And then also Roka sunglasses. I'm wearing their sunglasses, which if you guys haven't seen their new brand or their new line specifically for running and biking, it's pretty awesome. I actually was able to wear a pair of their testers in Arizona and I refused to give them back. So I was like, and these are never being returned. And so pretty amazing. So I'm pretty excited about hooking up with those guys this year as well.
Oh, nice. And I assume still Cliff English for coach?
Absolutely. Like I said, that guy can't get away from me. He's stuck with me forever.
Yeah, whether he likes it or not. Did you prepay that check like 40 years in advance?
Exactly. I was like, and here's till I die.
And you said that there was a bike fitter when we were talking offline that you wanted to mention.
Aaron Ross. So Aaron was working with Faster out of Arizona, and that's kind of changed up a little bit here. And he's kind of out and about on his own for right now, but I'm sure he's going to land somewhere. But really just made a huge difference for me in 2017, getting me fit on my bike this year. So big difference.
And where should people check you out?
Well, you can find me on Instagram, Rebecca Beaker McKee. I also have my Peak Center Instagram account, Coach Rebecca. I've got Facebook. You can find me on Facebook with Peak Center Alaska or Rebecca Beaker McKee or just Rebecca McKee. Those are the best places to find me.
Yeah, I'll link everything in the show notes so everyone can find you, because you've got a mix of, was it dashes and underscores and things like that?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I should throw out too that I was sponsored for quite a while and still working with Triumph Lingerie. And so those guys have been pretty fun to work with over the years as well.
I am going to have to raise an issue with that or about okay. that with you. More than once, okay. I've been scrolling through Instagram and my wife has seen over the shoulder, like, who is this? Like, it's a triathlete. It's okay. It's a triathlete. She's really fast. I'm following her for sport motivation.
Well, you know, I have a lot of fun with them and their clothing. And that's the fun thing about them is they're international. So they're more known in Europe and Australia than they are in Canada and the US. And so when I go other places in other countries, people kind of recognize me from them. And that's kind of funny. When they approached me, I was like, well, how about if we do this in a fun, sporty way? And I don't know if they totally knew what they were getting into, but they have seemed to be enjoying it and having a good time with it. But I always think to myself, what if I want to run as a politician someday? Or, you know, I'd probably just, you know.
Hey, apparently anything works now.
That's right, especially here in the U.S.
And
right?
I'm on this side of the border. Everything's safe. Well, I mean, we've got a cover model for our leader.
Oh, that's awesome. See, all right. I'm totally fine then.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. He has done shirtless, like half undone jeans kind of photos. And yeah, he's our leader. I don't know if you want Trump to be in a shirtless, half undone jeans photo, but I mean, there's hope.
I think that would be kind of traumatic.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I've just lost dozens of subscribers.
Right, exactly. Yeah. We should never go political or anything.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much here, Rebecca. Everyone should check out all the notes and where to find you on the website, triathlonterran.com. So thanks.
If there was anything on the podcast that you heard and you want to know more about, you can visit our show notes at triathlonterran.com/topics/triathlonterranpodcast. We'll have all of the links listed there. Any other info that you may not have had time to write down or whatever, it's listed there for you in perpetuity.
Something newer, juicier, freer.
We love free.
We've had resources kind of scattered throughout the website for the past year that we've built up. Well, I have put that all on one single page on the website at triathlonterran.com/free resources. Just by entering your email address, you can get a free swim drill program, a free strength training program, a running drill program. And as we start coming out with things, everything will be there. So you can check it now. You can check it later.
Come early, come often. Mm-hmm. We'll be adding stuff all the time, so make sure you check it out frequently. Also, if you've got questions for Taryn, and many of you do, and you leave them in the YouTube comments, Facebook, Instagram, etc., we're trying to aggregate that all into one spot so everybody can see and hear the answer. And that's why we've now launched the Triathlon Trainiask podcast, because it's Trainiacs asking questions. So what we want you to do is head over to triathlonterran.com/Trainiask. If you have a question, you'll record it and Taryn may answer it on the podcast. He's recording them every single weekday, and you can find the podcast on every single podcast player out there. And Trainiask is spelled TRAINIASK.
Short nuggets of info. Every right. episode, I guarantee under 10 minutes.
Perfect.
And it's hard to get me to stop talking. So this is a feat. Finally, last thing that you can do is if you like this show or the Trainee Ask show when you check it out, head over to iTunes, give us a review, good, bad, indifferent, hopefully 5 stars because we're pretty awesome.
Reviews just really help us out.
It really helps with the iTunes algorithm. However it happens, it works, it's internet magic and helps other new or aspiring Trainiacs discover us. So that would be much appreciated.
Thanks, folks. See you next time.